Well, as we reported, the Summit County Council last night sat down with members of the Eastern County Agricultural Preservation Committee and wrestled with the question of whether funds from the ESAP program, as it's known, can be used to help preserve riverfront land in Oakley. Joining me now in the studio to discuss that and some other issues, I have Councilmember Roger Armstrong. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So there's, I don't know, you guys still haven't decided how, whether or not it can. I mean, what are your thoughts on how to resolve?
I think it can. I think the ordinance appears to me to be broad enough. I think we've already heard from the county attorney's office that it fits, that it should be something that could be used if we want to. As with all things, we just have to figure out, you know, the county is always about trying to find which drawer we can take money out of to do just about anything. The state of Utah makes sure that counties have limited budgets to work with and limited sources of revenue, and those sources of revenue typically have to be applied in accordance with what they're allocated for. So, you know, we're always looking to find ways to reach our goals and how we can do that best. So we've allocated both possible TRT money and ESAP money for this, and we just have to make that decision.
Yeah. So is there a difference, though, between agriculture and open space?
That's a great question. I mean, there's a difference, I think, in the minds of some members of the community on the east side. If you say the words open space, they recoil from that. It's not, you know, we got a letter from a resident yesterday who says he's a fan of John Adams and that, you know, if open space is something that we believe in, is important in that ESAP plan, that's not something he's in favor of. But at the same time, the ESAP plan says on the agriculture side, it would be preserved by putting conservation easements on it or by buying it in fee simple. So it still winds up being tantamount to open space if you do that. It's got grazing on it. It's got, it may have some limited ag properties, but there won't be development on it. So from the naked eye, it looks like open space.
Yeah, but we specifically called it the Eastern Summit County Agriculture Protection Program. We didn't call it the Eastern Summit County Open Space Protection Program. So it sounds to me that there is a difference.
No, you actually have to read the ordinance. If you just rely on the title, I guess it could be confusing. But the very first paragraph of the ordinance says that it's designed for the preservation of both open space and agricultural land. And it makes it clear throughout the ordinance that that's the purpose.
So is this just one of those philosophical old county versus new county questions?
Probably. I think, you know, keep in mind, this was not passed by the current council or even the council prior to us. This ordinance was passed by the county commission just before we changed the form of government. So it's been around for a while, since I think 2009 or so. I can't remember. No, 2005, I think, is when it was passed. So it's been around for a little bit, and it shouldn't be causing controversy at this point. I think, you know, some members of the committee wanted to determine that they wanted to emphasize agriculture over open space. And, you know, I think the council would like them, when we have people serve on our boards and commissions, we like them to serve in accordance with whatever that process is that they're supposed to be working with.
Okay, so there was a little bit of testiness between you and board member Mike Brown. Basically, after the exchange, I mean, you invited any ESAP committee member to resign if they're not going to follow the county's ordinance, and then that meant that Mike Brown then left. So did he resign?
I don't know. I haven't talked to Mike today. Again, if you're going to serve on a board or a commission for the county, they're set up for a particular purpose. They're usually some sort of guiding documents or ordinance that govern it, and we'd like people to comply with that. If you don't believe in the ordinance, you probably shouldn't serve on the committee. It's kind of not a good fit. Or if you believe that there's something broken in the ordinance, then you should bring it back to the council and let's have that discussion. But I think we tend to resist having members of boards and commissions unilaterally decide that they're going to interpret something in a way that it wasn't intended to be interpreted.
Well, you did make some appointments to the East County Planning Commission, those reappointing Sean Wharton, adding Tom Clyde and Bill Wild. These folks were chosen why?
I think that each one of them brings particular skill sets. You know, Sean, we like the idea of keeping some consistency there. He's been on the Planning Commission for a while. He was part of the team that walked the current development code through. So I think having that institutional consistency and memory there is important for us. Tom Clyde has been a member before. He's, you know, he's a former city attorney in Park City. He's a smart guy. I think whenever possible, if we can get people with skill sets that fit well, it works for us. And Bill Wild is also somebody who's familiar with the code and familiar with land planning. So he brought a skill set that we thought was important, and he represents a lot of the interests in Northern Summit County. So it made sense.
All right. Tell me a little bit about Bill Wild.
Bill Wild is he's a surveyor, and I think he's a developer in North Summit County. He's been around for a long time, and, you know, he's got some pretty clear ideas about how things may wind up being developed and how careful we need to be, especially in terms of you know, making sure that we've got safe water supplies. You know, the whole septic sewer notion, he believes that if we're going to have growth at some point, we're going to have to move to sewer, and that's going to have to be solved. And that's a good point of view.
All right. Also, a discussion with regard to the solid waste operation and how to better achieve the county's goals there. You made a number of comments, first noting that sometimes people don't understand about diverting waste from the landfill. I mean, basically, we think if we're throwing it into the garbage, that's where it's supposed to go, right? To the landfill.
I think that is the problem. I think this is one of those sensitive areas. You know, I think all of us are challenged on a daily basis as we look at whatever we happen to be holding in our hands to determine whether it's recyclable or goes into landfill waste. And we also have, some people may not know, but we also have a construction waste landfill in Hennifer. So we've got different places where waste should go. And just using a generic term of diverting waste, I don't think it's the best way for us to communicate to the public that they need to be thoughtful about where things go and educate them. So it really does start at these basic framing points to make sure that we're communicating with very clear language so that people can understand.
Yeah, it really starts standing in the store aisles, yeah?
Yeah,
in terms of what to buy?
Making choices, sure. And that's about, you know, can we keep stuff out of the landfills?
Yeah. Let's see. Republic reportedly has said that Summit County is one of the worst areas for contaminating recyclables. That's not good news.
I still think we struggle with it, you know, and that contamination. It's easy to do. You know, you look at a glass bottle, especially. We have a population here. Our residents come from all over the country, and there are different means of recycling all over the country. And, you know, in Los Angeles, you kind of dump everything into one recycle bin. It's glass, it's paper, it's everything, and they figure it out. Here we have a little bit more sensitive system down in Salt Lake in terms of plastic bags can't be recycled because they clog the system, it costs more money. There are other things that affect that. So it's a matter of us continuing to educate the public. You know, we got a commitment from Republic Services to start putting labels on cans to make it a little bit easier for people to figure out. I understand that that's started to happen, but it's been almost a year, I think, since we've had that conversation. So we'd like to see that. I had a conversation with Insa Rippon a week ago, and she said that, you know, that kind of labeling makes a difference.
Yeah, and there's, you know, we had labels on some of the garbage cans, but they last all of like one rainstorm. So, I mean, the ones they have in Southern California, they're painted on with a stencil.
That's,
you know, exactly
right,
what to put in before you open the door.
And I think Republic has expressed some concern that recycling changes. So if you stencil things on a can, then the next week you got something different.
Well, they know they're not going to take glass and plastic bags. So you could put like a big no plastic bags, no glass, and be...
I think that's right. I think that's right. And I do think we can do better. I have been pleased to hear KPCW has been a great partner in that way. They've got Reese and Republic Services on a regular basis. They're running PSAs. So that education campaign seems to have expanded since the last time we talked about it. And, you know, people have to pay attention, too, to what they're doing.
And are we doing enough to involve the Hispanic community?
It's a great question, and I ask for that. As you look at the proposed board members that they talked about to be on this effort to redo our solid waste master plan, I think it's a good idea to have members of the Latino community come in and participate in that on a firsthand basis.
During council comments, Chairman Chris Robinson mentioned briefly about talking to Representative Bishop's office and accomplishing a public lands initiative for at least Summit County. So would that work?
I don't know. We haven't had a chance to talk about it. You know, we were very solid participants in the PLI process, and Kim Carson and David Ure spent a lot of time, I think, up in the Uintas looking at the grounds that were going to be protected, spent a lot of time talking with various stakeholders, including people from Wyoming that have some grazing interests in the North Slope and in some of the other lands areas. And we worked out a very carefully crafted multi-party proposal for the congressman to include in the PLI. And we just couldn't get that adopted. It, you know, they would make some changes, little changes, and then other things would come back in that, that just didn't work. So I don't think we want to go through another process that's a frustrating process, but if it were a meaningful process, it could work.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
That's all I've got.
Okay. Roger, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Leslie.
Summit County Council Member Roger Armstrong. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. 8:30 now. Good morning. Well, coming up tomorrow, the Summit County Mental Wellness Alliance, along with Connect and the Park City Community Foundation, putting on a morning-long discussion to talk about solutions and resources for mental health and substance abuse. The keynote speaker is Leon Evans. He's the president and CEO of the Center for Healthcare Services. He joins me now on the phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
So the topic of your address tomorrow, this is happening 9 a.m. at the Blair Education Center at Park City Hospital, is Getting It Right on Mental Health and Substance Abuse, the San Antonio Experience. So I guess I'm calling you in San Antonio, right?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. So tell our listeners and what problems that you had in San Antonio and how you got it right.
Well, this is kind of a national tragedy around the United States. Many, many years ago, states started closing state hospitals, and the promise back then was that those dollars would follow people into the community for treatment. And because at that time there were new antipsychotic medications and community-based services opening up, and you know, our hopes were people wouldn't have to be institutionalized and spend their whole lives in an institution because they had a untreated illness. And the problem, of course, is that funding didn't follow people into the community, so there were bad outcomes when people go untreated. The average severely mentally ill person in the United States dies at least 25 years sooner than the general population. Many times they go undiagnosed and untreated, so they're self-medicating with alcohol and drugs, and we know what that does to your body. More than half the cigarettes are smoked in the United States are smoked by people with mental illnesses. And, of course, we know what that does to your heart and lungs. So these people are dying early, but they're not dying of their mental illnesses. They're dying of congestive heart failure and liver disease and lung disease. And, you know, usually they don't have insurance and they're unfunded. So they're a major reason for the cost of health care going up in the United States. In fact, Malcolm Gladwell wrote an article for The New Yorker called Million Dollar Murray, where he follows an Afghan vet that had post-traumatic stress, who started acting out when he got back stateside and got a dishonorable discharge. And, of course, he started self-medicating with alcohol and drugs and became homeless and you know, ended up costing the healthcare system over $1 million in unfunded treatment, you know, when he died, and he died early.
Yeah.
And go ahead.
So it doesn't sound like it's a case of the chicken or the egg. It really sounds like many of our substance abuse problems arise from untreated mental health issues.
Oh, yes, of course. There's no doubt about that. When people are self-medicating with alcohol and drugs, they're having problems with their families, they're having problems at their jobs, they're having, health problems. And, we live in a stressful society, and, you know, I'll give you an example. Law enforcement officers tend to die earlier than almost any other profession because they're in very stressful jobs, and many times they don't know how to, you know, relieve that stress because, you know, you got to man up when you have jobs like that, so it's not acceptable to get treatment. So they tend to start self-medicating and start having, you know, family problems and health problems themselves. You know, the homeless issue, the chronically and persistently homeless are people with mental illness and addiction problems usually co-occurring. They go untreated. If you Google the cost to taxpayers of the homeless, you'll get all kinds of studies. The cheapest I saw when I did it was $30,000 a year. These people have lots of contact with law enforcement. They're in and out of jail. They're in and out of emergency rooms, and they, too, die early. And treatment works. I mean, that's the sad thing about this. And so we have lots of people come and visit us from not only all over the United States, but all over the world. I think we've had seven countries, you know, come and visit. In our homeless count, downtown San Antonio is down about 88% from when we started these programs. The number of people going to emergency rooms unfunded and getting bedded in hospitals is down over 50%. And so we have, you know, all these great outcomes and data to prove it up. But what people are really amazed about is how'd you get everybody to work together. And that's the exciting thing about Park City, and one of the reasons I'm excited about coming, because it sounds like your community is coming together to start addressing these problems. And so it's, you know, it's the family members, you know, it's business people, it's the hospital system, it's your law enforcement, your mental health system there. And that's the key, because these people end up in so many different silos. So how do you blend, braid, and integrate state, federal, and local dollars and kind of drive out the waste and duplication and concentrate on outcomes rather than process? And when you start doing that, you start having, you know, phenomenal turnarounds, because these people really are ill. People tend not to be kind to them or reach out to them or get them any kind of treatment. So when that does happen, they tend to do very well, you know, for sure do much better than most people think that they would.
Yeah. Well, with regard to substance abuse, so we often hear how we can't help people who don't want to be helped, or can we?
Well, the answer is yes. So one of the things that we did here in San Antonio is we developed a sobering center. And beside the sobering center is a detox center. So we have a lot of homeless, rather than when they do lots of petty crimes. And rather than taking them to jail and sticking them in the sobering tank, they were brought to this sobering center. Almost everybody that works in the sobering center is in recovery. So we do a lot of motivational engagement. I've been in there before when staff have been on their hands and knees, telling these folks, you know, hey, I used to be sick like you. Don't you want to go on the other side of that wall? There's a detox center. And we're treating these people not like, you know, homeless people are like drunks or addicts. We're treating them like human beings. And about 20% of those folks a month over these last many years have chosen to go to detox. Well, detox is a necessary intervention that really doesn't work too well. Your listeners probably know lots of people who have been through detoxes, and probably some very expensive ones, who tend to relapse over and over again. Lindsay Lohan is a public person that we all know about, who's been to many detox centers. So what we do have after detox, what's important is how you maintain your sobriety. So we have a homeless campus here that's an alcohol and drug-free campus. We operate two dorms there called In-House Recovery. They're 120-day programs, so you're someplace where you're not going to be tempted to relapse. Just because you're detoxed doesn't mean your brain is working right. So you're there long enough that your brain chemistry starts working. You start figuring out what you've done to your children, your family, your friends, yourself. You learn about your disease. You start learning how to manage your disease. We use an evidence-based practice called Seeking Safety. And so, 120 days alcohol and drug-free, if you've been sober, clean and sober that long, you really have a fighting chance to maintain your sobriety. And so a year after that program, over 50% of the people who have gone through that program are still clean and sober. Many are working and living independently. We don't have any horses to ride or swimming pools to swim or sunsets or beaches to walk on. But that sober living and in-house recovery program is the real secret to our reduction in addiction.
Versus the 30-day program that insurance covers.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it takes four times as long.
Sure, and many insurance companies only pay for a few days for alcohol or substance use detox. And you go back to your same environment, and you know, then we wonder why you relapse.
Yeah. So what are some of the other programs that you instituted that made things right?
Well, a lot of these people, because they have strange behaviors when they're untreated, they have lots of contact with law enforcement officers for one reason or another. So we have trained over 95% of the 6,000 certified police officers in Bexar County in what's called crisis intervention training. So they're trained to recognize the signs and symptoms of mental illness and alcohol and addiction problems. And they're also taught to use de-escalation talk-down procedures. So rather than getting in somebody's face who's psychotic and paranoid and barking out orders, they step back. You know, they use a gentler voice, talk these people down and take them to treatment rather than taking them to jail. To the point here where, you know, people just don't get shot that have illnesses. Law enforcement and the public really is at risk many times for minor kinds of offenses. When young officers go to academies, you know, over probably the last 20 years, we have really militarized academies. I mean, it's almost like going to boot camp. You learn how to shoot your weapon. You learn how to do takedowns. You learn how to use your command voice, your command presence. The problem with that is officers only need to use those skills probably 10, 15, 20% of their time. The rest of the time, they need to have other kinds of skills because their encounters are going to be with people who have these emotional disturbances, with some kind of family disturbance, or as we saw in Missouri recently, you know, some kind of racial tension. And if you have high emotions and you're using your command voice, command presence, and body armor, things escalate and things get worse and people get hurt. So both our sheriff and police chief here in Bexar County require all their officers to go through this 40-hour training. And I think the reason they do that is because they want them to have other tools in their tool belt so they can kind of get back to better community policing. And so that's, you know, something always people comment when they come to visit us about how skilled our law enforcement officers are in responding in an appropriate manner to people that have these kinds of disorders.
Well, you're credited with getting it right. Again, you're going to be addressing a crowd tomorrow, 9 a.m. at the Blair Education Center at Park City Hospital, Getting It Right on Mental Health and Substance Abuse, the San Antonio Experience. I appreciate you sharing a few of your insights with us this morning, Leon.
My pleasure. Thank you. And I look forward to being in Park City.
KPCW News Time now, 8:42. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, joining me now in the studio with a season wrap-up for Team Park City United is the director of the program, Hatch Haslock. Good morning, Hatch.
Good morning, Leslie.
So the season wrapped up when, officially?
Well, officially Sunday? It was just about a week ago at the U.S. ASA National Championships. We finished up the free skiing portion. Yeah, so great season this year.
Okay, well, tell us about some of the highlights.
Well, I think, you know, just on the very highest end this year, we had three alumni. Some are still working with us a little bit that won World Cups. So that was pretty darn cool to have that. We had a lot of athletes have their first experience skiing at World Cup level. So we were pretty busy traveling around a lot. We had numerous athletes that did very well. One of those alumni who's on the British team also won a bronze medal at the World Championships in slopestyle. So great season for those upper tier athletes. And then we have had some of those kids that got a chance to ski those first World Cups, things like that. We had Marin Hamill and Rel Harwood here of Park City, you know, that grew up, you know, they're in the winter school right now. And Rel ended up 21st overall in the world on the AFP rankings. So she's been nominated to the U.S. rookie team. So that's a pretty huge deal. Both those girls, along with Jack Kariotis and Nikita Rubaki, got invited to the Junior World Championships. Jack Kariotis won the moguls there, so that was huge. So we have a Junior World Champion coming out of our team here in Park City. And then Marin finished fourth, you know, just missed the podium there in the ladies' slopestyle. And Nikita competed in halfpipe as well as slopestyle, so that was pretty cool at that level. Junior Nationals, our kids just crushed it. And we had a lot of, like I said, a lot of these kind of kids moving on to the World Cup. So we a lot of the kids that we would normally be taking to juniors didn't go this year. And so we're like, okay, well, we'll see what happens. And I'll tell you what, the kids just stepped up and filled those roles. We had first and second in men's and women's slopestyle. So, you know, some of those, like Ashton Glass getting second, who's, you know, started with the team when she was six. So, you know, it's been pretty fun to watch some of these kids really come up and blossom. But we had first and second, both men's and women's slopestyle, and then half pipe side, Zoe Atkin won her first junior national championship, and then Nikita Rubacki was second there, so that was pretty cool. And then we had Cal Carson, who's a winter school athlete as well, got third in the half pipe. He was one of the guys that got second in slopestyle as well. So lots of great results. Ali Masuga, a young girl coming up, hit the podium, got third in big air at the junior national championships, and then she ended up winning the overall. She does everything: moguls, aerials, half pipe, slopestyle. She even does big mountain events when she has a chance. But so she won the overall combined event, which was pretty cool, and she's just 13 years old, so you know, definitely big future ahead of that young lady. We had another youngster, Henry Townsend, who won everything in his age group, but he also finished on the podium in the overall because he does moguls and the whole shebang as well. So that was pretty cool. Zoe Atkin winning the women's free skiing combined, and then James Kanzler, who's now skiing in all three events in free skiing as well, podiumed also in slopestyle as well as on the free ski. He took third in the free ski overall. So,
okay. So what happens this summer then?
So this summer we get started. Actually, the programs have rolled out on the website. So if you want to get started with us in the water ramp, we have mogul camp starting as early as May 5th. So our camps are up on the website right now for all the moguls programs. The free ski camps will be going up this week. But we have water ramping beginning June 2nd. And out at the Olympic Park, so we have those programs rolled out. We did reduce the prices on the punch passes to encourage some of the local kids to get out and try it out. And we also will have some development camps that we're going to be offering, so keep an eye out for those too. Some ways to get in real affordably and just give it a try and come out and play with us at the water ramp. There's a new airbag that's being put in at the Olympic Park as well. That's a big, absolute state-of-the-art, you know, newest design. It's a sloped airbag, so essentially a big air jump landing on a hill, you know, and being able to ski out the bottom of the hill all on an airbag, which is we're really super excited about. The U.S. ski team and local communities really helping to fundraise that. The Olympic Park, of course, helping out with that significantly. So there's people want to help us out with that. I know the U.S. ski team still fundraising for that, trying to, you know, finalize that. But it looks like that should open mid-July, so we're super excited about that. And, geez, there's lots of stuff. I mean, the Youth Sports Alliance, which is the reason why I'm here right now, which is our biggest supporter, they have their local programs going on. They have sign-ups through next week for the Activate program, the final session of Activate, and Get Out and Play. And you can sign up for those at ysaparkcity.org. All of our summer programs are on teamparkcityunited.com. So it's a lot of letters, one word, and you can find everything there. But yeah, the USASA Nationals, I didn't even get into that. But we won the open slopestyle as well as the 14-15 slopestyle for the men, which are the two toughest categories that are out there. We took first and third in both of those events. Local Zane Severson winning his first national championship, so I want to make sure to give a shout-out to him for that. We had local Michael Prue hit the podium in the ski cross, so that was pretty cool. And then our kids, you know, a lot of our kids do everything, so they did very well in the overall. We had first in open class, second in the U14 category, and you know, a lot of great success.
Okay. Hey, Hatch. Thanks for stopping by.
All right. Thank you.
KPCW News Time now, 8:50. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour on KPCW. Well, for months, Park City and Summit County art organizations have been working on an arts and culture funding initiative. The plan is about to be presented to the community. In the studio with details, I have the director of the Park City Summit County Arts Council, Hadley Dynack, along with Board Member Alex Butwinski. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So, I don't know, maybe, Alex, you have a little bit more history. I don't know. Just talk a little bit about the genesis of this. I mean, right now we do have a funny mechanism for arts and culture through the RAP tax, yeah. Recreation Arts and Parks Tax, but not enough, or?
Well, I think it goes back, like, I was lucky enough to come on the board of the Arts Council right as a group of people from the community, in part and in most part actually led by Randy Barton, to get us to focus more on what arts and culture means to who we are as a community. So, yes, over time we've had funding from RAP and we've had funding from Restaurant and for the Arts Council. But then all the other groups, all the arts and culture groups, have had their own funding, either through donations or whatever. And it just became clear that maybe in order to be the complete community that we wanted to be in 1998 when we did our visioning and said, you know, arts and culture are an important part of who we are. In a large part, as I said, Randy said, we need to focus more. And he went to city council, he went to county council, and he made a pitch for what we need is a master plan. And it took a while for us to get to that point, and that's where we are now. And, you know, I think Hadley can equally explain what we've been up to and where we're going. And I really feel fortunate I came on board at exactly the right time because I'm very passionate about this, and I think a lot of members of our community are. And we can really make great strides into a master plan.
So we do have the Recreation Arts and Parks Tax. That's like 0.1% on all sales tax revenue.
Right.
So how much does art and culture get from that every year?
Well, it's definitely a big number, couple hundred thousand dollars a year spread among a variety of organizations. And that's an application process. It's a grant process. It changes every year. And one of the things that we hope will come out of master planning is a more consistent source of funding. It'll be beyond just the RAP tax, as we like to call it here, beyond the restaurant tax. And those will give us an opportunity to really have a vision. Where do we want to go? What's it going to mean? How does the community work together to create a good arts and culture community that works together and is a vibrant arts and cultural community?
So the master planning is done?
No, the master planning is just beginning. So as we've been talking about, you know, about a year and a half ago, all these arts and culture leaders came together really to advocate and say, we need greater stability, we need greater support for our creative sector. You know, I don't think that there's any question that we have incredible arts and culture assets here, right? We've got over 15 nonprofits programming, nationally known and locally grown talent, musicians and dancers and visual artists. We have individual artists that are making it their life's work to share their talents with our community. We have strong arts and culture in our schools. We have a growing creative economy where we have local entrepreneurs that are building and creating products such as chocolate or coffee or ski poles and selling them to our community. So we have all of these amazing assets, but unlike other, and I guess the point that I want to make there in addition to the amazing assets is that they haven't happened by accident, right? They've happened because committed, passionate, smart, creative people have made it their goal to take a vision and move it to reality, whether it's a nonprofit organization or an entrepreneur or an individual artist. And that's happened in an organic way, as far as I understand it, in our community. Unlike other priorities like open space and recreation, where we've had a very concerted, intentional community process, and that has resulted in infrastructure that's outstanding, right? That's significantly improved our quality of life over the last 20 years. We haven't done the same for arts and culture. So that's what this really is about. For the next 9 to 12 months, the Arts Council has been asked to lead a process where we will collect data, we will talk to people, we will understand kind of what the needs, the wants, and where the collective priorities are, what the funding requirements for that are, so that we can develop a roadmap for growth and sustainability of arts and culture in our community.
So we're not necessarily talking about funding yet. We're just trying to find out kind of where we are, ground zero here, right?
Right. And the funding right now, there is some funding for the master planning initiative, and the business community and the nonprofit community, citizens have stepped up with individual contributions to make this happen. And I think as we go forward, the opportunities, as Hadley said, is, I mean, we can be an incubator for artists. We can provide space for them to work out of through our new development, you know, and get developers involved. And it really will be a collaborative community effort, and that's, I think, what makes it so exciting. And it's not just a study. We're collecting data. We're involving the community. And then we're going to have an action plan that, you know, it may take 10 years to fulfill what the objectives of the plan are. We'll have some easy wins up front, and we'll begin to actually implement. Because the last thing, certainly as my public experience has been, we do a lot of studies, and we need to really start to implement the things that we study and the things that are time to do.
So what's the timeline on this? You said 9 to 12 minutes, just to 12 months to study this?
Well, again, it's not just a study. We're hoping one of our core values actually is to think big but to find small wins along the way. So to back up 1 second, this kind of group of leaders came together, presented to city and county council. Both city and county council then appointed liaisons to participate. A steering committee was formed with representatives from a variety of key sectors. So we have business leaders, we have philanthropy leaders, we have nonprofit leaders, we have individual artists that are all coming together to kind of lead and guide this. Then we've got a series of work groups that we're convening over the course of this project to really provide substantive guidance and ideas. And so I think through this structure that we've designed, we will identify some problems that are easier to solve than others. Some are big, long-term, need a lot of money problems, and some are easier, smaller wins that we can work towards. So it's not just, as Alex was saying, a study that we will do for 9 months. We will do a lot of community engagement, and I think that we'll be ready to launch that at the beginning of May. So I'd love to come back at that point and talk a little bit more about the identity for the project and how people can get involved, because there will be a lot of ways, and we really need extensive public and community engagement to make this work.
Yeah. Real quickly, though, I mean, any concern by you both that residents are financially tapped out? I mean, certainly, as you know, we've got the $25 million open space bond looming. We've got increasing water rates, increasing stormwater fees. We've got an increase in the city resort sales tax, an increase in the sales tax for transportation and transportation funding, and now likely a school bond. So,
I know,
when you look at arts and culture, I mean, where does that fit in that?
Well, it gets scary. I totally agree with you. I mean, we're all residents of Park City, and we're looking at some huge potential increases, which I think we're going to have to prioritize. And I think a lot of what may come out of arts and culture, we already have a big investment at the individual level, and at the nonprofits get, you know, support from the community. And that's more voluntary, and maybe one of the things we'll be able to do over time is engage more public entities in becoming involved, and the business entities, which will be separate from the things that we voted for. I mean, we voted for the sales tax increases. We voted for the bond issue. We may be voting on two more bond issues, and those will be interesting to see. But those are individual community decisions, and this will be a more voluntary decision. And I'm hopeful, as is Hadley, that we're going to have a big success here.
I just have another 30 seconds, Sally. So
okay, quickly. Well, I think that one of the goals of bringing all of these diverse stakeholders together is to look at creative ways that we can leverage resources. So having all of these people at the table thinking about financing at the get-go, hopefully that will set us up for some interesting alternatives. We're also looking at arts and culture not as something that sets over on the side that we need to advocate for separately, but that is part of the fabric of our community and can help advance our other community goals. So I think where there are ways that we can overlap with concurrent planning initiatives and use arts and culture as a tool, there's an opportunity for funding there.
Okay. We'll bring you back in May and figure out how you're going to do all of that.
Yes.
Thanks
a lot, Leslie.
Thanks, Leslie.
Look forward to
this morning.